Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Mayor Eric Johnson of Dallas, Texas, that's a Democrat in a Democrat city. Every city over 250,000, 300,000 people, pretty much controlled by Democrats in this country. Writing in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend, American cities need Republicans, and Republicans need American cities. When my political hero, Teddy Roosevelt, was born, only 20% of Americans lived in urban areas. By the time he was elected, that went to 40. Today, it stands at 80. Well, now it's going in somewhat of a reverse. As American cities go, so goes America.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
The top line is that American cities need Republicans, so he's becoming one.
I wonder what his aha moment was.
While Dallas has thrived, elsewhere Democratic policies have exacerbated crime and homelessness. Do tell. Do tell, Mayor Johnson. I realize this will come as a surprise to many. During the decade I spent serving my hometown in the Texas House, I was a Democrat. I prided myself on finding common sense solutions, worked closely with my conservative colleagues to improve policing, public education, water infrastructure. Never a favorite of the Democratic caucus, and the feeling was mutual. By the time I was elected mayor, nonpartisan office, you know, technically, just like it technically is in Chicago, but it's not, I was relieved to be free from, by the time he was elected, I was relieved to be free from hyperpartisanship and ready to focus on solving problems. A solutionist, Eric Johnson, the newly minted Republican mayor of Dallas, Texas. How about that?
I love this part of his piece in the Wall Street Journal. To me, this is something that should not alarm any member or citizen of Dallas, you know, as if there's going to be some kind of uprising. We have a responsibility. We're going to continue to serve. I know that's my commitment.
I wonder if that will precipitate any other reflection, not even just by office holders. I don't see BLM Brandon going to side of the aisle. I don't see Eric Adams doing that, although...
You know what? If there was going to be anyone that would do it, I think it would be him.
I'm sure there are some mid-sized mayors that would be mid-sized, you know, mayors of mid-sized urban centers that would be more likely, but...
Mayor of Denver?
But it's more interesting in terms of how that will be received in Dallas and if that prompts any reflection among voters. American cities need Republicans, and Republicans need America cities. This alleged symbiotic relationship, is that true? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Meanwhile, in this city, our mayor is being ridiculed.
Oh boy.
By the same Wall Street Journal, although in the editorial pages. Well, that was not bad, too. But by the editorial board, he's not ridiculing himself. Being ridiculed, of course, because he's set to become Chicago's grocer magnate.
I got to tell you, I was in Utah over the weekend, and that's all anybody wanted to talk about. And they even said, well, what's going to be the name of the store? And I said, well, the host of Chicago's Morning Answer said, give me that.
Yeah, it's a part of the Gimme Dat family of companies, your Gimme Dat real estate development in the financial district.
Right, and it's going to lead into restaurants. But I mean,
right.
And
Gimme Dat Grocers will fund the Gimme Dat restaurant chain where
it'll be the Gimme Dat housing project.
You have no sub minimum wage. It's only minimum wage. So that the house can keep a little bit more. Yeah, I mean, there's a whole, we were talking a bit about this on Friday, Ralph from Rantoul, the our chief marketing officer.
Oh, yes. It's, that's
who
what
came up with the Gimme Dat name.
Uh-huh.
We were starting to develop, you know, the panoply of sectors we'd like the city to get involved in. And so there's some real promise there, I think. Maybe some promise on the Gimme Dat trading floors, too, because another offering, this was over at Zero Hedge, I saw, another suggestion that maybe that $800 million a year business known as the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, Chicago Board and Mercantile Exchange, there may still reflect on whether or not to stay here, even as a LaSalle Street tax doesn't seem in the near term, but it's still sort of hanging out there. And when you have Ralph Martiri of Roosevelt University, he's an academic, saying that the city cannot subsist on its current stream of revenue. No, of course not. It's got to be more. Always is. Always more. More is needed. And when you're going to spend, I don't know, a couple few hundred million dollars a year at least on all of our new friends from the world over, this welcoming city, that puts even more stress on your current revenue streams, doesn't it? Yeah. I don't know, that Eric Johnson, I don't know, it'd be interesting to see what reaction or hear from him, even what reaction he's getting privately, not so much in Texas, where he's a known quantity, and obviously, as he indicated, maybe he's sort of an independent-minded guy. Well, obviously, he's an independent-minded guy, but that has ruffled some feathers of Democrats in the state of Texas. But I wonder, conversation with other big city mayors, what the reaction
is. I wonder
if
Mayor Oscar Lesser from El Paso is next. I mean, he's beloved over there. He ran, he was mayor till 2017, left for some personal problems, and ran again and won by 80%. And he's had enough. I mean, they had the largest crossing of migrants in the history of crossings in August. And then just the other day, 2,000. And he's even saying help. He's even asking Governor Abbott, I need help. So they're bringing more buses in to take people out. There's not even enough room on the streets near District 2, which I know you guys don't know about it, but it's near Paisano Drive, and there's nowhere for people to go. It's an absolute invasion.
Jim in Sheboygan, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yes, I think we could get a revenue source for the city and put together some T-shirts and some stickers that say, Gimme Dat, and under it, the answer. And I think we can market it, and I think it'll go over well with the city, and I think maybe the mayor will like it.
Yeah, I'm on the job on that. Thanks for the call, Jim. I've taken it upon myself to start to, you know, you got to merchandise, you got to market. So we're working on that.
But as people pointed out, that I was talking to, government-run grocery stores like Venezuela, Nicaragua, the shelves are pretty much empty. So what's the point? I mean, it's not. You think that's going to work? Government doesn't work in general in Chicago, and having a grocery store chain is absolutely going to be a disaster.
Well, just you just think about it. Maybe just this is, again, a time for some quiet reflection, and you think about what it is you think the city or the state of Illinois does well. What's something that when you think of city government or you think of state government, you know, I really feel like I'm getting value for my tax dollar.
There's not one thing.
Well, just some quiet reflection on that.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Now, from the Signature Bank studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Matt Gaetz was on with Maria Bartiromo yesterday to talk about this quote-unquote government shutdown, the prospect of a quote-unquote government shutdown, which, as you know, as I know, as we know, having lived on this planet for a minute, we've had 21 of these over the last half century, including under Trump just a few years ago. And it's always what? It's always the temporary paid vacation of a quarter to a fifth of the federal workforce.
Right. And they say millions of Americans are at risk of losing their paychecks by the end of the week if Congress can't work out a deal, yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually they will get paid.
I don't care. And the issue is really one between Matt Gaetz and Kevin McCarthy, Matt Gaetz being the most outspoken critic of how Kevin McCarthy has handled this, that Kevin McCarthy is not honoring his commitment that the committee made in January to get the support he needed to become speaker to do single subject bills for up or down votes. And this is the only way to stop or at least slow down the runaway spending in D.C. Well, this was a point of contention because Bartiromo, like many Republicans, thinks Gaetz is grandstanding and he's interfering with the Republicans' winning messaging right now on the economy, on Biden Incorporated. Majority of Americans think Biden is corrupt. They think he's too old for the job. They don't like the way the country is going. They feel less economically secure than when Biden took office, which is why Trump's up 9 points on Biden in this latest ABC Washington Post poll. So it's all going well, the story goes. And Matt Gaetz is the skunk at the garden party. Is that right? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Here's sort of Gaetz's view on this in summary, as he presented on Bartiromo Show, Maria Bartiromo Show yesterday.
Now joining us, one of the people holding up an agreement to fund the government, Florida Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz. Congressman, thank you very much for being here this morning.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad I get to respond to your monologue, because if you're saying that I'm standing in the way of all the Republican wins, I'd love you to enumerate them. Watching my friend and mentor, Jim Jordan, it was quite painful because he started by saying we should only pick one fight, the border. But then as the interview went on, he said, well, we should pick a second fight, Jack Smith. And by the time the interview rounded out, he was saying that we shouldn't be funding Ukraine without a plan. And yet the very continuing resolution that you and Jim Jordan seemed to be for continues to have $300 million more for Ukraine. So I think we ought to fight on all fronts. I think the border is very important. And the best way for us to advance the Republican border policies is to pass the Department of Homeland Security Appropriations Bill, do that along with veterans, defense, ag, state and foreign ops. We'll have 73% of the discretionary budget funded. And if, you know, the Department of Labor and Education have to shut down for a few days as we get their appropriations in line, that's certainly not something that is optimal. But I think it's better than continuing on the current path we are to America's financial ruin.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Are you persuaded? Is Gates doing the right thing, publicly holding McCarthy's feet to the fire? That's what he would say. Or is he being a grandstanding obstructionist, as probably McCarthy would say quietly, and many Republicans are saying less quietly?
I don't know. What do you think, Dan?
Well, let's get Bartiromo's response.
Okay.
Get the full debate here. Bartiromo's response, Gates said, these GOP wins you speak of, enumerate them. Here's her enumeration.
Well, how about the fact that he has set up a weaponization committee to investigate the DOJ, whether they're involved in a cover-up?
That's
how about
process.
The fact that he has... Hold on.
Wait
how about
a second.
The fact that he... Hold on. How about the fact that he has set up the China Select Committee to keep China to account? And, of course, he has launched this inquiry into impeachment, potentially, for President Biden. Is that not what you want?
None of those things are deliverables. Those are steps in a process. Setting up a committee is an end unto itself only in Washington, D.C.
But
the American people demand results. Hold on, I'll let you talk.
Okay,
Maria,
go ahead.
These committees have done nothing to reduce inflation. They've done nothing to actually constrain the Biden government. We can set up committees and have hearings and yell at people, but at the end of the day, if we still send the check to fund a weaponized government, having a weaponization subcommittee is little relief to the American people. And if any of this was serious, we would be sending out subpoenas and compelling process the way the January 6th committee did. We should be operating like them. Instead, we're playing patty cake with the Bidens. We're allowing them to get away with it. And we're funding it. We're sending the money. If we were serious, use the power of the purse.
All right. Now, what do you think?
I think he's grandstanding. I just do. And I know his political future, you know, I don't know if it's official or not, but that he wants to run for governor of Florida when DeSantis's term is out. And he's not working with other Republicans. He's not doing what's best for the party. And I understand the Ukraine, you know, funding Ukraine and all of that. That's not really what he's pointing out here.
I'm of two minds a bit on Gates, and also generally speaking, and also in this instance. I mean, he's certainly right that, you know, setting up a committee is not an accomplishment.
Right.
That's not a deliverable. Only in D.C. is that a deliverable. It's what you produce in furtherance of what you said you were going to investigate, find, accomplish. Right. The committee is the vehicle to do something. Along the lines of a promise you made, ostensibly. But I still think, as I said last week, when we got to this discussion with Steve Moore and others, I still think that there was an opportunity here to turn this back around on the electorate and say, look, this thing, you know, just don't spend a lot of time worrying about this hysteria the media is always trying to induce on these matters. But if you want things to change in this country, if you don't like the direction this administration has taken the economy, for example, if you feel less economically secure than you did before he took office, as we know you do based on the polling, then you may want to think about continuing to support Democrat senators and, by extension, Chuck Schumer as the Senate Majority Leader. You may want to consider stopping, hey, suburbanites, you may want to consider to stop supporting socialists in places like the western suburbs of Chicago, who are going to go to D.C. and support a Speaker Jeffries, or who knows, maybe a Speaker Pelosi, since she's running again. Regardless, if you want us to, if you're truly serious about these things, then you can't make it make sense. You're not being honest with yourself when you turn around and you support the Sean Castens and the Lauren Underwoods and the Brad Schneiders of the world in places like Bill Foster's, in places like Illinois, Chicagoland. And we can go state by state and give the examples in suburban Milwaukee and suburban Atlanta and so on and so forth. The suburbs or urban centers that essentially have become the base of the extended base of the Democrat Socialist Party in this country. Seems to me like such an opportunity for both Gates and McCarthy and the Republican caucus to communicate with a single voice on this topic and avoid some of this this public spatting. Doesn't bother me, but I just think there's a bigger, better play here.
I mean, AOC now is refusing whether to say she'll help Gates oust Kevin McCarthy. And she said, you know, she was on CBS Face the Nation, that she'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
She's irrelevant. She's completely irrelevant. You think that Gates is going to partner with the Democrats? You think that would help his political future if he partnered with Democrats to oust McCarthy? Of course, he's not going to partner with AOC. This is an internal matter. But I think Gates trying to depose McCarthy is a bridge too far. He's now that's grandstanding. All right, Corey and Woodlawn, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, there's a great line in the movie Coming to America.
Amy's never seen it.
You're going to bring that up.
Yeah, he tells them, if you have no more money, you can cause more mischief. And that's pretty much all they're doing in D.C. It's causing multiple rounds of mischief. Gates is right. We have to slow down the spigot of money to D.C.
Thanks, Corey. Well, that's a good reference, and you're right that he's right. He is right, what he's saying in principle, but then there's sort of the political reality. And so taking his criticism of McCarthy and turning it back on him, right? I mean, you know, beating the drum is not accomplishing anything either. You have a problem in terms of the distribution of power in D.C. You have a majority of Democrats and spendthrift Republicans in the Senate, and you've got a narrow majority of Republicans in the House, and of course we know who's in the White House. So the idea that you're going to do something paradigm shifting on spending here, you just don't have the votes. So that's why it seems to me the bigger, better play is a unified call for a lot of suburbanites around metro areas in this country, and a lot of urban dwellers too, you know, to get their heads out of their asses and perhaps deliver it just as plainly as that. Craig in Mount Greenwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy, and thank you very much for taking my call. Okay, hopefully Gates is not grandstanding, because, listen, there's never any substantive accountability with these Democrats. No matter what McCarthy promised and talked about, no follow-through. All talk, no action. The Republicans, there's never anything. It's all a bunch of bull dung from these people. They talk. Hopefully it's not, and everything like that, and hopefully there's some accountability somewhere with something that they keep talking about, because Democrats get away with all of their garbage against Republicans constantly.
Thanks for the call, Craig. Frank in Arlington Heights, by the way, we are workshopping the Frank in Arlington Heights History Minute.
Oh, is this for Freedom Summit? Is it a breakout
session?
No.
We're going to be featuring it on the show, the History Minute. So we're working that out. We still have to do some branding. Frank has to decide what nom de plume he wants to use.
Similar to your 60 seconds of sanity.
Yeah.
And my 30 seconds of crazy.
Yeah, maybe we should bring that back too.
Yeah.
All right, Frank in Arlington Heights.
45 this time.
Well, good morning. Sounds like a great opportunity. Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we'll call it Gimme Dat History with Frank from Arlington Heights.
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah, all right. Well, we'll continue workshopping. All right, go ahead.
Anyway, you know, we're still in the age of Roosevelt. Roosevelt, I said it the right way. You know, and Johnson, too. I mean, all the programs that he created. And those are both viewed as really good presidents today. Much like Louis XIV, you know, was viewed by a lot of people as, you know, a great king of France back in the 1600s, 1700s. But he created all that debt. And that just continued under Louis XV and Louis XVI. And look where that led to in France. And now, today, most people would recognize Louis XIV as, you know, being a, you know, somebody who just spent a lot of money and drove his country eventually into bankruptcy.
Right.
Like
the Roosevelts did.
I mean, yeah, like Roosevelt and Johnson and the progressives have done. I mean, we have $33 trillion in debt. Right now they're viewed as great, but, you know, 50 years from now, who knows? Where is this going to lead us to? I don't know.
Thanks for the call, Frank.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Which team are you on? Education Secretary Miguel Cardona wants to know. What team are you on?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
There are two teams, and here's your choice.
So can you please tell me, or can you please define for me, what is a woman?
Our focus at the department is to provide equal access.
That's the old Cardona. We'll get to the old Cardona, just giving you background on who he is. But here are the two choices, which team you're on.
You know, I've been in education, about 25 years, not including the time I was in higher ed as a student. I've never seen it where it is now. There was civility. We could disagree. We could have healthy conversations around what's best for kids. I respect differences of opinion. I don't have too much respect for people that are misbehaving in public and then acting as if they know what's right for kids. Or people that have a problem when we're trying to provide some support to folks who are buried in debt and complain about a $10,000 support for thousands of their constituents but are okay taking over $1 million in loan forgiveness themselves as an elected official. That hypocrisy, I want to call it out at the top of this conversation, because there's a team that's fighting for kids and there's a team that's fighting against kids.
Which team are you on, the team fighting for kids or the team fighting against kids? I assume Miguel Cardona is saying he's on the team that's fighting for kids. Of course, Cardona wouldn't be able to tell you who's on that team, at least wouldn't be able to tell you the sex, because per that other clip I started playing, Miguel Cardona, who's been in education.
Not including his own time in school.
For 25 years.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that doesn't include my time at, you know, from K through college. Yeah. Okay.
Thanks, Miguel.
He testified before Congress when under questioning from Congressman Andrew Clyde from Georgia. And he had the same problem with that trick question that KBJ, Supreme Court Justice KBJ had, remember?
So can you please tell me, or can you please define for me, what is a woman?
Our focus at the department is to provide equal access to students, including students who are LGBTQ, access free from discrimination.
Okay, well, is that mm-hmm. So what's the definition of a woman? You haven't given me that. You haven't answered my question.
I think that's almost secondary to the important role that I have as Secretary of Education.
My question is not secondary. My question is very simple. What is the what does HHS say the definition of a woman is?
I lead the Department of Education, and my job is to make sure that all students have access to public education, which includes co-curricular activities. And I think you highlighted pretty well the importance of Title IX and giving students equal access, whether it's scholarship and facilities.
Okay, so you're not going to answer my question.
No, he's not going to answer. No. Fighting for kids or fighting against kids? Although he's he laments the loss of civility. And he can, of course, agree to disagree with people. But if you disagree with him, then you're on the team fighting against kids.
And he rips, quote unquote, misbehaving parents acting like they know what's right for kids. We're their parents. We're in control of the kids, not the government.
I just love the whole look. I can have productive disagreements with people. I can I respect people's opinions, even those that don't agree with me. And I just have to let them know that they're on the team that's fighting against kids if they disagree with me, because that's how fair-minded I am.
This guy is so tone deaf. I met Miguel Cardona when he was driving around a bus. I think it was 2 years ago. Welcome back to school bus. And he's sitting there in Chicago on the west side. And I said to him, you're driving around this bus. There's 17,000 plus kids at home right now locked out of government schools because, quote unquote, they were close contacts. They don't even have COVID. So what is the celebration for? And then he gave some bull jive answer. And they're like, press conference is over. And then they got him back on the bus. Ugh.
So
he's a puppy. He's a clown like you would bring to a block party.
There's some things happening on the K-12 front that Miguel Cardona may want to take judicial notice of.
Yes.
Parents misbehaving and some legislators misbehaving, too. The team that's fighting against kids. On Friday, North Carolina became the 10th state to approve universal school choice. Ooh. The Dem Socialist governor there, Roy Cooper, who is a wholly owned subsidiary of the teachers union, like most of the politicians in Illinois. He is not going to veto it because he's going to be overridden if he does. Thanks to a flip. Here we go. We started the show with the flip. We got another one. Representative Tricia Cotham, former Democrat, who became a Republican, giving Republicans the 3/5 House majority they need to override Roy Cooper's prospective veto on expanding school choice to all in North Carolina, increasing the funding by a factor of 3. All North Carolinians are eligible, and then the amount of the scholarship declines as the household income increases, which is fine, fair enough. But Tricia Cotham, she sends her son to private school, and she said that, by the way, so does Roy Cooper. Sends his daughter to private school.
Of course he does.
Tricia Cotham said, though, that unlike the governor, as a policymaker and a mom, she would be a hypocrite if she voted to deny her constituents the same choice she has. So she crossed the aisle to become a Republican in April. Oh. That's the team fighting against kids. So Miguel Cardona and his teachers union bosses would say, wouldn't they? Texas. Teachers unions, actually, you know, it's a fight everywhere. Teachers unions were able to prevent universal school choice from moving through the Texas state legislature, but Governor Greg Abbott is calling a special session next month to pass universal school choice for every child. And here again is another opportunity to challenge the voters. If you think this is right and proper, and you would like to access these opportunities for your kids that you can't otherwise access because of the cost, then maybe you want to think about not supporting teachers union flunkies for state legislative offices and for federal offices for that matter, too. But of course, here, this is mainly a state issue. Makes a big difference. For example, compare what's happening in North Carolina, what's happening in Texas, what's happening now in 22 states. Yeah. I think that's where we're at. To what's happening in Chicago, what's happening in Illinois. I mean, we've gone through this many times, but here again, it's revenue they need, they say. As results we want, we say. And then there's this disconnect. They get the money, your money. They take your money. They don't produce the results. They get reelected. That's a problem, and that's on the voters. Our friend Ted Dabrowski over at wirepoints.org, some new analysis of Chicago. Just in 4 years, the per pupil spending, 2019 to 2023, has increased by almost 50%.
And what have we gotten from that? I mean, nothing. I think conditions have gotten worse.
The percent of students proficient in reading has gone down among every demographic. It's gone down in total. It's gone down. I mean, slightly gone down. But it's the numbers are terrible. And they've still lost ground after spending nearly 50% more just in the last 4 years. All told, only one in four CPS students can read as proficient at grade level, proficient reading at grade level. 26%. 54% whites, 17% black, 22% Hispanic. Math, it's even worse. And the drop has been much more substantial. Still spending 50% more. Only less than one in five CPS students are proficient in math. Meaning, you know, doing math at grade level. 48% white, 8% black, 13% Hispanic. By the way, the 8% black is down from 13% proficient 4 years ago. The 13% proficient Hispanic, that's down from 22% just 4 years ago. Up by nearly 50% in spend. Down, I mean, on the math, it's really something, particularly with the minority students. Those are huge percentage drops, and you're starting from a pretty low base, aren't you? Which is also criminal. So the opportunity for people that care about Chicagoland, care about Illinois, care about kids' education, to point this out and challenge your neighbor. Challenge people. You can't know this and continue to support the same people and consider yourself a good person. You're not a good person. And people need to be told this. You are a bad human being when you are propping up politicians that prop up this system that produces these results. And don't tell me your scare stories about Republicans, because Americans all over the country aren't buying it. So I'm not going to let you get away with your rube, with your ghost stories, and with thinking you're a good person if you're part of this. How's that for a conversation at the block party? Who's ready to have it? Well, if you're not, then you also don't get to pretend that you care about Chicagoland, you care about kids' education, you care about the future of the state. There's the real choice between who's on the team fighting for kids and who's on the team fighting against. You want to be on Cardona's team? Because that's where a lot of people in Chicagoland are. And even if you're not an active propagandist for the unions like he is, your silence puts you on his team.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, I got another song, another artist who's got a bit of a cultural message in his music.
Okay.
Have you heard of this country singer, Blind Joe?
I have not.
Yeah, Blind Joe. He's from the land of 10,000 lakes, I think, Minnesota, Dakota's area. He's got a song, not quite Oliver Anthony, but it's getting some attention. Like, you know, some of the rappers we've had on that have gotten waded into politics. It's been kind of fun. This one's kind of fun, too. You ready for it?
Mm-hmm.
I Will Not Comply, Blind Joe.
Trying to take me to task, cause I don't want to wear a mask or take a vaccine that could maybe make me die. They got no scientific evidence to back that crap up. All they do is feed us lie after lie. That's why
our 10 divers up, even if we got the shot in the arm. But nobody's talking about exercise or eating food that's fresh grown from the farm. That's why I will not comply. Quit trying to take me to task, cause I don't want to wear a mask or take a vaccine that could maybe make me die. They got no scientific evidence to back that crap up. All they do is feed us lie after lie. That's why I will.
All right, what do you think?
Pretty catchy tune.
Yeah. You like it?
Yeah.
It's not bad. Now, the big guy, Mr. 10% President, not as big a fan. He's more of a rap fan, as he was recounting the other day.
Dear
I'm representing the groundbreaking legacy of hip-hop in America, LLJ Cool J.
Yeah.
By the way, that boy's got, that man's got biceps bigger than my thighs. I think he's been...
No. Don't use the word boy.
Don't use the word LL Cool J if you can't say it.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Now, from the Signature Bank Studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This is the big guy's favorite artist.
Oh, LL Cool J.
Representing the groundbreaking legacy of hip-hop in America, LL J. Cool J.
He's so hip.
LL J. Cool J.
So down with the struggle.
You don't vote for Joe Biden. You ain't black.
Remember that? Yeah.
That'd be a lesson
so
to you.
Pathetic. It just shows how senile and out of touch he is. But whatever. Keep it coming.
So this bite's been making the rounds on the interweb there.
I thought the internet was going to go away.
Not a fad. Louis C.K. This is from an appearance he made on the Joe Rogan show earlier in the year. On Open Borders. And it's, you know, Louis C.K. is the typical, like, left dilettante. I mean, he's funny, but he's an idiot. You know, he doesn't know anything, like most of these celebrities. So it's interesting, you know, this can be interpreted a couple different ways, whether he was sort of cosplaying the white leftist for the purpose of setting up the comedy, to come at a later date, effectively, or whether he was just serious. He was trying to, like, sound intelligent, and this is explaining the positions, the left's position on border security, which is they're against it. Either way, I think it's actually a pretty fair representation of what the thinking is if you talk to somebody who supports these sanctuary cities and thinks this what's going on with the lawlessness at the border is all wonderful and we need to be a welcoming country. They buy the rap that Brandon Johnson is selling. Take a listen to Louis C.K.
But my feeling is they should open it, the border, and just let everybody pour in. And then the answer, which is, well, then there will be all these problems. Yes, there should be. It shouldn't be so great here, is what I'm saying. In America, it shouldn't be. It's a weird thing to sequester a certain group of people and try to keep upping their lifespan and their lifestyle and just keep trying to increase that for this group of people. And then this pressure of people trying to come in so they can enjoy it. And then it gets worse and worse down here. I mean, I'm not Canada. It's really just from down here. There's something wrong with that. That's not a system that's working. And it forces people to do cruel things to other people. There's a lot of people that die so Americans can be safe. Mm. They're just dying, you know, weddings that are drone bombed in Yemen because a guy said something that might have resulted in American insecurity. Not even like definite American deaths, but like just so we can breathe a little easier. Folks die. And folks do labor in unsafe places so that we can keep the prices where we like them. There's so much about American life that other people pay for. That's part of it. But also, it's not good for us either. It's not a good way to live in a gated community, you know? If you let folks pour in, like any other wave, it'll kind of slosh. And then you'll just – things will be different. I don't know, like, there. What'll really happen? A bunch of people, like, will they just come with knives and start killing everybody? I don't think so.
A Venezuelan man in Texas did commit a murder, but okay. Was he joking at all, being sarcastic? Well, or is this him being genuine and this is the way he really feels?
It really doesn't matter that much because it's more that what he said, whether he said it facetiously or not, I don't think it was facetious, but even if it was, That's how people really think. I mean, that's a viewpoint of the new Marxists. That's their actual view. They couch it in the welcoming city, but I mean, they have disgust for America, and again, hypocrisy is attended to their privilege as you know the vanguard class, so they can have the good things. But to the extent that, especially honkies. Feel upset about something or their privilege. They would say their privilege is under assault in some way. They're worrying about their status. They're worrying about the great replacement, which of course makes them racist. This is the point that Louis C.K. is making, which I think a lot of people in a place like Chicago actually believe. You shouldn't have it so good. You have it too good. You have it too good through the exploitation of others. And so now is the reckoning. And the reckoning comes in the form of open up the gates and anybody who wants to come can come. And we're going to be not only welcoming, but we're going to be compassionate and providing all of the basic necessities of life because we've gotten so much through illicit means. Because we're bad people. We shouldn't live like this. You can't live like this, Lucy. It's not a good way to live for us. We're parasites, you see. I think that's how they actually view it. I think if you ask Carlos Ramirez Rosa or Andre Vasquez in the city council, I think they would nod at what Louis C.K. was saying.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick text message, another text message. This might be the greatest example of a luxury belief I've ever witnessed.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, but they would say that Louis C.K. and those, they would say, well, that's, you know, you have a luxury belief in border security, believing that you have some sort of God-given right to live in this rich country and be protected from, quote unquote, protected from other people, insulated, I guess they'd say, because there's no need for protection. You just heard him say it. What are they going to do? Like start kniving everybody? No, of course not. These are all good people that have good intentions. And to the extent that this would upset our lifestyle in any way, well, it's about damn time. So they would say we have the luxury belief, you see. And it all starts from this premise that, you're lucky to be born in America. This is all true. But then nothing, I guess, matters from there. It's like the sort of immutable condition of being born of one race or another. And then there's supposed to be all these benefits or obligations that flow from that rather than on your conduct.
Well, why does he want us to have programs? I mean, again, he said if we allow open borders, America is going to have a lot of problems, and that's good.
Well, he's saying that they're not. I don't know if he said a lot of problems, but I think the whole point is what I said is it's gonna change America, but America needs to change. It needs to change from being this white supremacist patriarchal society, and maybe. With a bunch of single men from Venezuela, we can change America into something better.
Or now what? American citizens and have work visas?
Well, they're not American citizens.
Well, but they're here legally now and they don't
for
18 have to worry.
Months.
Yeah, they don't have to worry about being deported. I'm of the mindset where we should shut the borders and keep the barbed wire up. And I'm sure you had this on Friday where Border Patrol agents were literally cutting the wire in Eagle Pass, Texas.
Yeah, that Abbott's National Guardsman put up, and then he was having to task him to put more of it up. But regardless, I mean, you're not going to stem the flow with barbed wire along the Rio Grande. You're just not.
No, that's not working, and the buoys are not working either.
We know what the numbers are. Obviously, none of that's working, and it's purposeful.
But the gates, because the gates are open along in Nogales, Arizona. There's no wall. There's no gates. They opened the gates to let people in.
Well, I'm still
getting home with anybody. We're being invaded, and nobody seems to care.
Still hoping for the 10 cities.
Well, they're coming.
Cook County is spending about $14 million to buy two suburban hotels for the unhoused, those who are housing insecure. We used to call them homeless, but
shh, don't say that, Dan.
$7 million in federal pandemic dollars. Federal pandemic dollars used to buy a hotel for the homeless. Interesting. The Margarita Inn in Evanston.
Oh. Didn't you stay there once? Is that an all-inclusive?
The
Margarita Inn with free chips and salsa.
I have not stayed there. The Margarita Inn, too. Apparently, it's within walking distance where Jan Schakowsky lives. Do stop by.
Oh, please do.
Stop for high tea.
Maybe they could put a yurt tent city near her house.
Well, the other thing, too, is, you know, we may not go with tent cities because your buddy Andre Vasquez is not so keen on the tent city idea, particularly if it's going to be provided or built by Garda World, this Virginia-based company that's got the $29 million agreement with the city because they had some involvement with what Ron DeSantis was doing in Florida.
Yeah, they were hired by Governor DeSantis to transport those migrants to Martha's Vineyard. So what? Yeah.
Well, so what? So we're not going to let you build our tent city. You ain't going to build tent city. And we're going to go with, maybe what Vasquez was saying previously, which is permanent structures. You know, like Cook County is doing in Evanston. Buy some hotels or eminent domain people's homes, whatever you have to do to provide the shelter that they deserve.
And it's so crazy. I mean, I have this list of where migrants are being housed, and they're in all these wards except for, Andre Vasquez's ward. A lot of progressives don't have shelters in their wards yet, and this is just not right.
Well, I also want
the YMCA in the 4th ward.
You got to check out, too. I mean, I would definitely encourage you folks out there to put a call into your county chairman's office, to county board members. See if you've got some suburban counties, municipalities too, for that matter, that are having conversations with Chicago, Cook County, because you know Preckwinkle and Brandon Johnson are doing this together.
Yeah,
real collaboration,
a political mother.
Real collaboration going on there. It's wonderful. It's the first time in 15 years or forever since she's been the county board chairman that she has a real partner at City Hall. That's what Tony says about BLM Brandon, and she's right. Now, see if there's some outreach happening to suburban communities and counties, you know, municipalities and counties, for the suburban areas to house some of the migrants as well.
According to Garda World's contract, they're part of that deal is to build yurts or tent cities in DuPage, Lake, McHenry, and Kane counties. Did anybody read that? Are you guys awake out there in the suburbs? It's coming to you. Love it.
Jeff in Cal City.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, the only true, real secure border we have with Mexico is the California-Mexico border. Why doesn't the Biden administration tear down the walls? I mean, they have miles and miles of very, very tall, secure, concrete border walls. Why don't they tear that down? I hope if Trump gets as president, one day he'll actually just say, there you go, California. You don't believe in borders? Let's go rip down everything there.
All right, thanks for the call, Jeff. And we'll put a wall around California to keep them out of our country. Yeah.
I really want to ask why the 35th Ward, 40th Ward, Alderman Vasquez, what are you? You're asleep at the wheel here. Why they're dodging taking in illegals. 47th Ward, my ward's not on here either. Well, they're just at the 19th District.
Not yet. There's a lot more coming. I know There was a report out over the weekend. Abbott's still sending more migrants to New York, so they're not going
to
stop.
He has to. We had the largest intake of migrants. Month of August had 304,000 in 1 month. That's unheard of.
You saw
they broke. They're breaking records, guys.
You saw the conversation. We played that conversation with the one migrant talking to the border agent in California. Can I go to Chicago now? Sure, you can.
Do whatever you want.
We're here, free. Do whatever you want. Go to Chicago.
Go anywhere.
Tell Beal and Brandon I said hi. Marvin in Burlington.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment on Louis C.K.'s intelligence. The American public has lost 40% of its buying power approximately since Biden took office due to his war on petroleum. We are the most benevolent, giving country the civilization has ever known. If he wants a country that continues to be that way and help poorer countries, then we need to be a wealthy country.
We can help. We can help poor countries by becoming them. You see, you have to have the experience
economically.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't work that way. And if they're so hell bent on helping these people, why don't they instead of trying to hide their money in offshore accounts and tax havens, why don't they give more to the federal government if they believe in so much of that and invite these people into their homes and in their neighborhoods? Geez, I wonder where Louis C.K. lives and how many illegal aliens. I'm sick of the term migrants. They're not migrants. These people are illegally entering our country illegally, and we're letting them in.
Thanks for the call, Marvin. I don't think Louis C.K. is going to take in any illegal aliens, and I don't think they'd want to go to Louis C.K.'s place because he may ejaculate all over them. They might want to go right back to Venezuela or Haiti.
Text message, Dan and Amy, it is not the unhoused. It's the residentially challenged.
Yeah, residentially challenged. But I mean, seriously, you want to go Louis C.K.?
Gross. Didn't he do something to a potted plant? Oh, no, that was Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, it's tough to keep track.
What did he? Well, I don't. Yeah. Dan and Amy, who owns those two hotels? Well, doesn't matter. They're getting federal funds. This is like a win-win.
Well, it's like some wired up deal. It's a good question. I don't know. I'll look into it.
I talked to somebody from the hotel industry over the weekend who said they're trying in California to force hotel owners, if they have any vacant or any open rooms, it's been going on, but they're trying to fight it because they're lobbyists, that they have to rent those rooms out to homeless.
Yeah, we talked about that in the context of the mayor's race there in L.A. Karen Bass, the longtime congresswoman, beat that real estate developer. And one of her issues was supporting the imposition, the mandate on hotels to make open rooms available to the homeless, and the city will pay you X amount of dollars. She supported that.
Yeah, but they don't want to because they ruin their brand.
And L.A. residents had a choice, and they made the choice.
Yep, and got to live with it. Just like the Kappa Kappa Gammas, you made a choice. You voted in the transgender guy who's really not transitioning. You got to live with your choice, you woke idiots.
Clay in Libertyville.
Morning, Dan and Amy. I was going to use a little more sensitive word than ejaculate all over.
Yeah.
But when I'm coming to or looking for advice on how we should run this country, I'm not going to take it from a guy who exposes and pleasures himself in front of women without their consent. Have a great day.
Yeah, it's a high bar that you've set, Clay, in terms of you know, where you'll the people you turn to for advice. But I mean, I do hear what you're saying on that. Don and McHenry.
Hey, how you doing? Good morning.
Morning.
Isn't there something Congress can do about this in case the leader of the country goes crazy and lets an invasion happen?
It's already happening.
Well,
I know, but isn't... Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I mean, is there something Congress can do about it? Sure, they can do something about it. They have the power of the purse. This is actually the point that Matt Gaetz was making on Bartiromo's show yesterday. So whether you like Gaetz's style and strategy or not, I mean, it's difficult to argue with the point that you can bring some of these people and agencies to heel if you stop sending the checks to underwrite them. and then do a little bit of horse trading about, well, if you want this agency to be funded, if you want these people to stay employed, then over here, I mean, this is power politics. And over here, we're going to do something. You're going to come with us to do something on this matter at the border. Otherwise, we'll bring the whole thing to a grinding halt. Thanks for the call, Don. Something they could do. You know, it's just, it's where you want to spend your political capital, how much of a fight you want to put in. Glenn Oakbrook.
Yeah, good morning. Regarding the Louis C.K. comments, I think we need to focus on the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. The Declaration says that we have a certain unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the Constitution protects life and liberty. Pursuit of happiness, that's up to you to catch up on. So, but we need to focus on the Constitution. This we can't just change the country because somebody says we got to let everybody in, and you know, without any rules.
Thanks, Glenn.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560, The Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. What's your read on the Russell Brand situation? What do you think about Russell Brand? Is he being targeted because he dare to deviate from Hollywood orthodoxy on politics? Or is he just a lowlife who's using the deviation from Hollywood orthodoxy on politics as cover for past bad and potentially criminal behavior? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, that is 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Russell Brand was on video this weekend asking for support, and he doesn't just mean emotional, he means financial too.
Obviously, it's been an extraordinary and distressing week, and I thank you very much for your support and for questioning the information that you've been presented with.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why did it take so long for the allegations to surface? Because I feel like the women, I mean, and I don't know, and I feel like he's already being persecuted in the court of public opinion. I don't know if what happened, you know, if they were actually raped, but why did they wait so long? Because they seem like opportunistic women by coming forward now, years later.
They're all the allegations that I've seen are at least a decade old, right?
Yeah, that's a long time.
I mean,
somebody violated me or one of my best friends. You go right away. You go for the jugular. You want justice. You want them behind bars. I don't care about their celebrity status or their power or money. That's why it's so hard. All of these, the whole Me Too, and see, you know, with the that 70s show guy too. Him, you know, it's like,
well,
why?
he was convicted in a court of law of raping
true.
People. Danny Masters.
Masters, right?
That's a bit different.
A different story than this. Yes.
Yeah,
but both cases, convicted. Just why did they wait so long? And that's the problem that I have. And then they make it harder for real rape victims out there. But they might have been raped. I don't know. Not for me to decide. I'm not going to be on the jury.
Well, do you think that he's being... he's not the only Hollywood celebrity that's deviated from the accepted opinion on political issues. He's not the only Hollywood celebrity to say nice things about Trump from time to time. So... he's conceded that, you know, earlier in his life he was abused alcohol and he was very promiscuous. So I said all these things on my show, and you see him on these interviews that are resurfacing where he's, you know, behaving, you know, like a
Hollywood doofus.
Well, yeah, testosterone addled, you know, he's behaving like the character that he played in Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Oh.
He's behaving like that, you know, like sort of half out of his mind rockers just looking to score all the time.
But all these women,
or other things.
All these women together coming forward at the same time seems like a coordinated attack for some reason. And is it because he's political? Because he's not, you know, a mainstream Hollywood guy? Not a mainstream, sorry. He's not, you know, he doesn't toe the Democratic line. He doesn't toe the Hollywood mantra.
Well, it's more than that. I mean, it's more than not towing. It's not like I... I'm for lower taxes. It's like, you know, he's come out. He's been on Tucker's show. He's had Tucker on his podcast. He's talked about the deep state. He's talked about big tech. And, of course, now he's gotten deplatformed and demonetized by YouTube, which is in part why I guess he's hoping you subscribe to his Rumble channel so he can pay his legal fees and whatnot. You know, which, I mean,
that's fine. He's got to reinvent himself on another social media platform. I get that. And he should have the right to do so.
I would say that there's a lot of specificity to some of the allegations. And among the accusers is like there are at least one like person with a name in her own right. Mm-hmm. That Australian pop singer. What's her name again? I know she has a name and I forgot it. Danny Minogue. Danny Minogue branded Russell Brand a vile predator as far back as 2016, accusing him, 2006, accusing him of creeping her out by perving over her quote-unquote fabulous breasts and refusing to take no for an answer. Well, that's not criminal. It sounds like he could have been creepy, but that's not criminal. But, for example, one accuser said they had a relationship when she was 16, so that is criminal.
That is, yes.
A ex-girlfriend, Jordan Martin is her name, made allegations that he sexually assaulted her at the Lowry Hotel in Manchester, England, after becoming angry that she had spoken to an ex-boyfriend. That happened in 2007. She made the accusation in a book she wrote in 2014. Now it's all coming back 10 years later. You know, I'm a little loath to immediately like knee jerk jump to Brand's defense. The way that Tucker or Laura Ingraham have, but there are some legitimate questions of these accusers. And there's sort of different categories too. There's accusers whose previous statements are just being pulled forward to add to the story and to, you know, to continue the feeding frenzy. And then there are those making allegations in real time, even if they're older allegations. So it's a lot to unpack. The other thing too is,
what evidence do they have?
Well, the other thing,
you can say anything.
The other thing is, even if there is some merit to one or more of the allegations, there is no doubt that the press corps is purposely trying to make this as big a feeding frenzy as possible. They are trying to put as much air into this as they can. And so what does that say? Does that say, oh, we just want to know where the facts are, we just want to give accusers a platform, or we want to get this guy? I tend to think on that count, it's much more we want to get this guy than we have grave concern and empathy for the accusers. That's what they usually couch their headhunting in. So it sounds all high-minded, but it's pretty low rent.
Yeah, he said he denied all allegations and has said that all of his relationships have been consensual. He was interviewed 9 years ago by English authorities because a masseuse came forward and said that he groped her at his house and no charges were filed.
Yeah, there's something that just doesn't set right about this, but I can't make it out at this point. I don't really have a good feel on this, but I do have to say I thought this aspect of the story was telling of our times. Paramount Plus removes Russell Brand comedy special, but it continues to stream Harvey Weinstein movies.
That is so...
So, you know...
Therein lies the hypocrisy.
Well, who gets... You know, what's the standard and how is it applied? I don't know how you can parse those two decisions, how you can distinguish them on any basis of principle. Probably Paramount's decision probably does not generating a lot of money from Russell Brand live from New York from 2009. Weinstein movies, larger oeuvre, heavy rotation, probably an important part of the library, probably paid a lot of money for the rights. But it's not a matter of principle here. I mean, and maybe it's not even financial, although I think it is. Maybe there's something else, too. It's just, I don't know. I don't know how you would defend a Harvey Weinstein exactly. Or how you would move to expunge the presence of Russell Brand on all platforms and not do the same for someone like Harvey Weinstein. That's why these things are so confusing. It's difficult to determine when you have so many people with so little integrity that are part of the story, you know?
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, somebody texted, did I mean Kylie Minogue, one of the women who made an allegation against Russell Brand? No, I didn't. I meant Danny Minogue. That's Kylie's sister.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, you're so hip and in the know.
Well, I am. Matt on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. One thing I just read about recently is that this Tim Ballard from
Sound of Freedom.
Sound of Freedom. There you go. You know, he's kind of become public enemy number one in Hollywood. And now all of a sudden there's sexual allegations against him, sexual misconduct. So I don't understand. I mean, it looks like this is all political. And, you know, my thing with this, you know, celebrities being accused of sexual assault, I was just talking to my dad the other day. And I think from now on, if you got 15, 20 women coming together, you know, 10, 15 years later, I said, fine, maybe the last one that was assaulted, we'll take that seriously. All the other ones before that should be charged with aiding and abetting.
Thanks for the comment. Yeah, Tim Ballard is being accused of, it's not really sexual, they're not really sexual assaults, I haven't seen. It's like sexual misconduct.
Right.
This was Vice News did this piece on him. There's a handful of women.
A hit job.
He did separate from his anti-child trafficking organization, Operation Underground Railroad, and they made sort of a cryptic statement about doing an independent investigation, and we're updating our practices and so on and so forth, but we're not going to talk about this out of respect for the privacy of all parties involved. But then there's also this sort of high-profile repudiation of Ballard from the church of, I guess he's Mormon, the Church of Latter-day Saints, a prominent leader in that church, said that he was separated, ties between the church and Ballard had been cut because of Ballard's quote unquote morally unacceptable behavior. But I mean, I haven't really heard the specific, I mean, I guess the specific allegation is an affair or affairs, plural, I don't know. But I haven't heard anything that rises to the level of criminality, alleged, I don't know. That's what I know about the Ballard case. So there's other parties involved saying maybe Ballard didn't always act in the most judicious manner, but that's sort of still separate and distinct from saying anything about, his work that was profiled in the movie.
What he's accomplished in his life. I mean,
well, that's what I mean.
Right.
So, right. So some of this is like just, well, it's like a political campaign. And so you're trying to smear people as best you can.
Well,
you use whatever information is out there to be used.
While he was trying to get kids out of human trafficking, they claim, according to the Vice article, they invited women to act as his wife on undercover overseas missions ostensibly aimed at rescuing victims of sex trafficking.
Well, right. I mean, you sort of saw that represented in the movie to some extent with the female trafficker who he flipped, if I'm remembering correctly, flipped to be part of the sting to catch other traffickers.
Right, and the lady said he would allegedly coerce them into sharing a bed or showering together, claiming that it was necessary to fool the traffickers. Which, I
which may, you know,
it makes sense.
Yeah,
to me,
right.
I mean, if you're going to go all in, you got to go all in.
Yeah, I mean, right. They're going to be sensitive to somebody infiltrating their organization, just like drug traffickers or any other criminal organization. Yeah, that does make sense. So, I mean, I'm not casting aspersions. I'm just describing the stories that are out about Ballard. And yeah, these are people that are not popular. And so if you get a story and you're a member of the D.C. press corps and you want people, you want to silence people who have opposing viewpoints, then you're going to take these things as far as you can take them. Do as much smearing as you can do with what's available.
He's popular right now, so get him.
There is something to that, for sure.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Now, from the Signature Bank Studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Jake from the State Department announced last week, Penny Pritzker is back in the game.
She is. Jake.
Penny Pritzker is going to lead Ukraine's economic recovery. Just as I saw Zelensky was dining with Ken Griffin and other billionaires, I guess, trying to get whatever he can from them that he can't get from the United States taxpayers.
Let me guess, he was wearing army green color. Never takes it off.
Penny Pritzker is going to manage Ukraine's economic recovery.
Well, they are Ukrainian, because Pritzker mentions that all the time. My grandfather was a Ukrainian Jewish man who came to this country.
Penny Pritzker was also a principal at Superior Bank. You may recall this when she was leveled up to be Commerce Secretary under President Obama, Joe Obama terms 1 and 2 during that period. And she was essentially the finance chairman of Obama's political career, starting in the state Senate to U.S. Senate to president. Superior Bank failed in 2001, taken over by the government. Superior paid the bank $460 million over 15 years. That was the deal to avoid litigation and to try to insulate the Pritzker reputation as much as possible. Failure left about 1,400 depositors out about $15 million. And Superior Bank's failure, where she was the CEO for a time and then she was on the board. 2002 report by the GAO found that the primary responsibility for the failure of Superior Bank resides with its owners and managers. Its strategy resulted in a high concentration of extremely risky assets. The high concentration of risky assets and the improper valuation of these assets ultimately led to Superior's failure. That's the woman who's going to rebuild Ukraine from the bottom up. Okay. Sure. I'm sure Jamie Dimon and other Wall Street titans will assist the effort. You know, the patriots that they are. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Don Boudreau. He's an American economist, author, professor, co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center. That's at George Mason University. He joins us now. Don, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. You guys in Illinois are really lucky. You've populated with superheroes. You have a mayor who can now run grocery stores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing the talent that's in that state.
We have an unbelievable concentration of talent. It sort of defies the odds, really.
And they're all in politics. You know, it's astonishing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's where the money is, it turns out.
They may be sinister, but they're not foolish.
Some bring it and make more, and some bring none of it and make it. But it's a lot of money to be distributed when you've got, more units of government than any state in the nation. That's a lot of opportunity for grifting, and there are a lot of opportunists here. Penny Pritzker at the top of the list. But, you know, this is the whole thing, too, about, you know, tell me again about the war effort and these blank checks that a large percentage of both parties want to write Ukraine, even as Poland, by the way, is pulling back. You know, oh, I thought Poland is going to be one of the next dominoes that falls, but apparently they don't believe so. So I'm just this is the whole, even if it's a you want to repel an invasion by a dictator like Putin's invasion. Yeah, then you have all these complications that these kleptocrats just make it impossible to feel good about, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, Putin's invasion is unquestionably an evil deed. My position has always been, I'm not a specialist in foreign policy, but my position has always been that the U.S. government should be really, really prudent before it gets involved in any sort of foreign affairs. I mean, I'm just old enough to remember Vietnam and what a mess that was. I was still a young man at the time. And so I do worry about the arrogance that people have about the ability of American arms and American dollars to somehow magically turn things around. But my bottom line conclusion on this is it's very complicated, and I think we should have more humility about it.
Well, did you watch the 60 right. Minutes piece last night where they talked about where the actual money is going to? And we've given them $70 billion, and most of it's going to fund and pay the salaries for Ukrainian first responders and for the people that are in charge of the search dogs.
Yeah, I mean it's hard to track when you look. It's hard to track money inside of the city of Chicago.
Yeah, no kidding.
How difficult is it to track American taxpayer money when it's going to a foreign country? Well, I just have to expect that things like this are going to happen.
Well, yeah, but we also, need more first responders here in Chicago.
Just the whole thing. The whole thing. Everything is a Marshall Plan. We need a Marshall Plan to rebuild. We hear this all the time in Chicago. Marshall Plan for the South and West Sides. We need a Marshall Plan for this. We need a Marshall Plan for Ukraine. We need a Marshall Plan for Haiti. Everything's a Marshall Plan. You know, I mean, it's just we got into supporting the Ukrainians to repel the Russians. And OK, I can appreciate that. I agree with you. Of course, the invasion was an evil act. But now we're going to have our industrial policy experts, alleged as they are, they're going to go and marshal the rebuilding of Ukraine's economy. I mean, that sounds like, oh, that's a wonderful thing. But I mean, as you say, come on.
It's not going to work. It's not going to work, by the way, no matter whose money is spent to do it. Those kinds of schemes to uplift an economy are destined to fail. You can't have bureaucrats and politicians allocating resources in contradiction to market forces and expect that the outcome is going to be good. By the way, the Marshall Plan, if you actually look at the performance of the Marshall Plan, it's way oversold.
I know.
Europe emerged from the war to the extent that Europe liberalized its economies and adopted market prices, the price system. We have this myth about the Marshall Plan today. Maybe at the margins it did some good, but it was not the magic sauce that brought West Germany and Europe back from the ruins. It was to the extent to which those countries liberalized their economies and adopted market institutions.
Yeah, the country that performed the best, I mean, since we're in this part of the world, that performed the best after the wall fell in 89, coming out of the ravages of communist domination, was Estonia. Because the president of Estonia at the time was this 35-year-old Friedmanite who wanted to make Estonia basically the Baltic Hong Kong of the time.
Yeah, and the proof is in the pudding. Estonia really did perform very well. History is pretty clear on this. The more restricted the economy, the greater the intrusion of politicians and bureaucrats in allocating resources, the worse the economy performs. I don't care, even if Ms. Pritzker had been the greatest success in American banking history, there is no way that she is going to direct the Ukrainian economy into some paradise. It's just not going to happen. It cannot happen.
Well, Dan, excuse me for going off script here. Weren't you a DJ in Estonia?
No,
you're a rap star. What did you do?
No, I was I bartended for a night at a rave that was hosted by Freedom Front, which was a libertarian anti-government organization in Stockholm.
Oh, not in Estonia. Yeah.
When I went to the World Libertarian Convention in Tallinn, then I went over to Stockholm, Don. And then, and then I had a little foray as a bartender.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, it was. It was actually pretty fun. It was pretty
fun. Did you get a lot of tips, or they don't tip?
Yeah, yeah. I was very big in Stockholm. I was in Stockholm like David Hasselhoff is in Germany.
I'll let my cousins know if they. Yeah. I'll ask them if they know your name.
You wrote a piece about the trade war, which tends to be pretty popular these days in both parties, this sort of sticking it to enemies of America that are bad actors often, like the Chinese communists. But punishing our adversaries or even our enemies with tariffs is not a winner for America, you argue.
That's exactly right. This is a piece that Phil Graham and I had in Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago. Tariffs are paid by Americans. American tariffs are paid by Americans, by and large. It does impose some harm on foreign countries. They're able to sell us fewer things, but the very reason they're able to sell us fewer things is because the tariffs artificially raise our cost of living by raising the prices of the things that we get to consume. And so the main effect of tariffs is to immediately reduce the standard of living of Americans. And this is what happened with the Chinese tariffs. In that piece we had this, and I double checked it with the data. Trump's steel tariffs and aluminum tariffs were designed to protect jobs in those industries. Combined, those industries, when those tariffs were imposed in 2018 and 2019, had about 168,000 workers in America because it's also mechanized. The number of workers in American industries that use steel and aluminum was about 36 workers for every one worker who actually work at producing steel and aluminum. And so what about those workers? They're unseen. And so because the price of steel and aluminum was increased due to these tariffs, the cost of operating the factories in America that use steel or aluminum as inputs, that went up, that reduced wages or reduced some employment in those industries. The effect on manufacturing employment was very, very modest. And after the tariffs started to take effect, the actual effect on that manufacturing output was lower in America. Manufacturing output was lower at the very start of the pandemic. It was lower well into the pandemic, but let's forget about the pandemic. It was lower at the start of the pandemic than it was at the time the Trump tariffs were announced. It did not increase output in America's overall manufacturing sector, and it no doubt in my mind, and there's some evidence for this, and no doubt in my mind, pushed down real wages, made real wage growth lower than it would otherwise have been.
There was this interesting paper on 50 years of industrial policy. These two eggheads from the Peterson Institute looked at 18 U.S. industrial policy episodes implemented between 1970 and 2020, and they sort of categorized what the different industrial policy gambit was intended to do. And they concluded was that the effect on they looked at the effect on U.S. competitiveness in global markets, whether the annual cost per job saved or created in the sector was reasonable, and whether support advanced the technological frontier. And what they essentially found is that import protection does not create a competitive U.S. industry. It imposes extreme costs on household and business users per job year saved. Trade policy concentrated on opening markets is a better bet. And designating a single firm to advance technology yields inconsistent results. They said among the 18 cases, the incident with the most return, the best record, was DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
That was more general. That really wasn't directed at
industries.
Yeah.
Right. So it's all these sort of things that you would expect. I mean, I don't really understand to some extent what we're arguing about here, because like their conclusions, they take a long time to get there, but their conclusions are what you would expect if you passed an Econ 101 course.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's what you would expect if you had read similar studies that were done in the 1980s when there was the last time a fever in the U.S. for industrial policy. People studied it back then. By the way, one of the people back in the 1980s or even 70s who was studying industrial policy was Charles Schultz, who was a Democratic, he's an economist, very good economist, but he was in the Carter administration, so he was no Republican. And he came to the same conclusion. Anyone who knows any economics or who knows any economic history knows that these industrial policies never, ever, ever improve the economies that they are supposed to improve. They worsen the economies. They may, in some instances, help particular industries, but, you know, so what? The object is to improve overall standards of living, overall economic mobility, overall growth in wages and incomes. Industrial policies simply fail to do that again and again and again.
He is Don Boudreau, an American economist, author, professor, co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center. That's at George Mason University. Also catch his work at Cafe Hayek, the blog Cafe Hayek. Don Boudreau, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We touched upon this a bit earlier in the program, but let's do so again per our upcoming guest. Miguel Cardona is the education secretary. And
he's no Rhodes Scholar, I can tell you that.
No, he isn't. He had this to say about parents. Effectively, parents insinuating themselves into the operation of their kids' schools. And sending the message that you're either on his team or the bad team that's fighting against kids. He's on the good team fighting for kids.
You know, I've been in education, about 25 years, not including the time I was in higher ed as a student. I've never seen it where it is now. There was civility. We could disagree. We could have healthy conversations around what's best for kids. I respect differences of opinion. I don't have too much respect for people that are misbehaving in public and then acting as if they know what's right for kids. Or people that have a problem when we're trying to provide some support to folks who are buried in debt and complain about a $10,000 support for thousands of their constituents, but are okay taking over $1 million in loan forgiveness themselves as an elected official. That hypocrisy, I want to call it out at the top of this conversation, because there's a team that's fighting for kids, and there's a team that's fighting against kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which team is the team that wants to kids to have scholarships so they can go to schools where the rich and the politically connected send their kids? Which team is that? Is that the team fighting for kids or fighting against kids, Miguel? Confusing. Which team is this? Which team is our next guest on, Kyla Posey? She filed a federal discrimination complaint a couple years ago. We brought you the story when it first surfaced.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of the most astounding stories I've heard as you span the country when it comes to K-12 education and bad practices. Filed a federal discrimination complaint against Mary Lynn Elementary School in Atlanta, did Kyla Posey, after learning her daughter had been placed in a class only for black students. The elementary school set up two classes for black students and six classes for white students. Kyla Posey's daughter, as I understand it, wanted to take a particular teacher. She was told she can't have that teacher because that teacher teaches the white students and you're in the black students. This is what year?
I know.
Is this pre-Brown v. Board of Education? So anyway, Kyla Posey, is she on the team fighting for kids or on the team fighting against kids? What would Miguel Cardona, wholly owned subsidiary of the teachers unions, have to say? I wonder. you literally had segregation of kids by race going on in this Atlanta elementary school. It's astounding, but it's true. That was happening. And I understand the principal didn't pretend it wasn't happening. They defended the practice. Provides more opportunity. A elementary school principal in Atlanta just overturned Brown v. Board of Education. We're back in Plessy v. Ferguson days at this Atlanta elementary school. Can you believe this?
And what are we doing about it?
Kyla Posey is doing a lot about it. She joins us now. She's the mother who filed a federal discrimination complaint against Maryland Elementary School. And she joins us at this juncture. Kyla, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me here.
So, just tell us, I guess, how your daughter's doing and where things stand with the school and your litigation.
Sure. So this has been a long journey for my family. It's been long and hard. It's emotional to think that we're having conversations about segregation in 2023. This conversation started because the principal the school that we attend is predominantly white. There's maybe about 12 kids that were black in her second grade class and the second grade. And the principal decided to take all of those 12 students and place them in two of the six classes, not allowing them to be placed in the other classes. If you were white or of any other descent, you could be placed in any of the six classes. But if you were black, you only had two options, which was a huge problem for me. It's not right. B, my children should have the same rights as everyone else in that school and the same access as everyone in that school. And that was denied by that principal.
And your daughter wanted a different teacher, right? She didn't want to be in that class with that particular teacher.
So, correct. My husband at the time worked for the school. He was the school psychologist. And this principal had allowed staff to select teachers. Most principals in schools, they do have that same policy. I've worked in the school district and been a teacher before for over, 20-some years. And that's always been the case. So I didn't think anything of it when she allowed that practice for staff to select. So I did most of the legwork for, our family and placement. And we thought that this particular teacher would be a better fit for our daughter educationally. And apparently that was not one of the teachers that she had selected as what she called the black classes.
I don't understand. So she argued the principal I'm talking about now, who is also black, right?
Yeah. That is correct.
So she argued this would provide more opportunities for black students. How?
That was my question.
And what was her answer?
She said that it built community. And I said, that's not your job. As a parent, it's my job to provide them with a stable community. They have cousins. They have a black experience, so to speak, in our household. We teach our daughters to be friends with everyone, no matter race, creed, color, whatever. You be kind to everyone. And also, we want them to understand that there may come a time where they may be the only black person at the table. And that's okay. And people need to be comfortable with that. Shutting them into a room is not okay.
I'm sorry. I didn't turn interrupt.
I was just saying that it creates an environment that people don't have to deal with black children.
Yeah, right.
No. It's really unfortunate.
Yeah. You mentioned that your husband works at the school. Did they run this by him or other administrators before doing this?
No, they didn't. Apparently, the administrative team was aware of this practice, and they just went along with it. No one challenged her.
It's just astounding.
What year is this? I mean, really?
No one said, No one said, are we sure that segregating kids by race is a good idea? Didn't we have experience in this country doing that before? That was bad, wasn't it? Or am I misremembering our history?
We asked that question to the assistant principal, and her response was that she was aware that it was happening, and that was the principal's decision. And she is also Black. Which was mind-blowing.
And what about the other parents? I mean, did Black and white students alike, especially when word got out about this, did you have parents rallying around your initiative to stop this practice?
It was interesting. There were quite a few parents that did rally in support, and then there were parents that thought it was totally okay because they felt like she was a good principal. And I explained to them, this has nothing to do with, or she's a good person. And I said, this has nothing to do with whether or not she's a good person or not, or whether I like her. It's against the law.
Right.
That's full stop.
Right.
So it didn't matter.
So,
I'm just having a hard time understanding how people don't look at this and say, are we back in the Jim Crow South? Is this what we want to do? And you're just going to you're sort of going to dress it up as this is providing more opportunity. I know we want society to be integrated. As you just said, we want everybody to have equal rights, equal access, chart their own course, parents involved. And this is just lunacy. I'm surprised this hasn't gotten more notoriety, frankly.
It was quite alarming for us. After we reported her, and the other piece, you know, we were working with the district. We had notified them at least, I would say, maybe a year to a year and a half before we even filed with the Department of Ed. So we were trying to work with the school district and telling them, hey, this isn't right. You know, what can you do? This needs to stop. And the district could not, they just couldn't get the principal under control. She kept retaliating. She was trying to move my husband's office. She tried to cancel my contracts. I'm an after school provider. That was one of my schools. She tried to cancel my contract. She had another principal cancel my contract. It was so much retaliation going on. And then at that point, I was like, listen, you know, we've been sitting here quiet, allowing you to work through this. And she continues to do all of these things. Like, you know, she's not just going to keep beating up on my family. And at that point, we felt like we didn't have a choice but to file. So then when we filed, it became worse. They started to retaliate against my daughter. There was a teacher saying really mean and cruel things to my daughter about me. One of my daughter got injured by another student. They didn't do an incident report. She told me she didn't feel that she needed to. They never investigated it. Yeah. To this day, that happened over a year ago. I've yet to receive an investigative report from the district. So people, you know, have jumped to her, her praise. And the reality of the situation is people don't know half of the story. So what you've seen in the news reports, that's probably only a quarter of the turmoil our family has been put through and had to go through.
Well, I was going to ask you how your daughters are doing, and are they still enrolled at that school?
We took our girls out this current school year. Our our neighborhood was rezoned due to overcrowding, and yeah. We were rezoned to another school. And because we had completely lost faith in the district and them being fair and impartial to our daughters, given the incidents with staff that they had not followed up on, we didn't feel like it was a safe environment. You know, it's sad when your fourth grader comes home and says, or she's now in the fifth grade, she's at a different school, and the first day of school, I asked her, you know, how do you like your new school? You know, is it working for you? Did you feel comfortable? And she said, Mommy, you know, for once, I felt like I went to school and the teachers were going to be nice to me.
Oh.
Were her exact words, which breaks your heart.
Yeah.
I assume the Atlanta school system is probably run similar to Chicago, where you've got mayoral control of the school system. And so, and if that's true, so any response from any politicians, a city council, as legislators, local, the mayor's office, local school board members, whether appointed or elected? I mean, anybody saying anything about this other than you?
Mayor's office was absolutely quiet, said absolutely nothing. My senators, Ossoff and Warnock, were very involved and engaged and wanted to see that this, you know, got cleared up, and they were very supportive. However, everyone else, I haven't heard a mumbling word. There's some representatives, that were, supportive in trying to help push, you know, things along, because it was taking so long for them to even come back and say that they would investigate. Since our initial complaint, we filed probably two or three others because we had a retaliation complaint. We filed complaint retaliation for our daughters. We filed retaliation complaints against my husband. They actually had my husband sit out the whole year at home. He had to work from home while the principal still reported to school as if nothing happened. And said he was basically, he, you know, was creating a hostile work environment, which was interesting because when the news broke, my husband wasn't even in the building. He hadn't been in the building for at least over a week, because we knew that we were going to file, and he had already spoken with his supervisor and let them know. So they knew that he wasn't in the building. So I'm, you know, pressed as to how does he create a hostile work environment and he's not there.
Right. And so these complaints are sitting in the bowels of the Department of Education somewhere, or at DOJ, or where are they at this point? You know,
correct. So they're at the DOJ, Department of Ed. They have acknowledged that they have our complaint at this time. They have, I'm assuming, working through all of the nuances. Like I said, it's so many moving parts to all of it because, you know, when we brought this to light, opposed to fixing the problem, it just, the principal ballooned it into something that it didn't need to be, and added another level with the retaliation. So now you have complaint after complaint after complaint because she just kept going.
Is she still doing this, segregating kids by race?
I am not for sure what she's doing because we no longer go to that school.
Right, But after you called her out and you brought this to public attention, she persisted with this?
So after we called her out, they did an internal investigation, the like third in command in the district, and she did an investigation and she reported back to us that, you know, yes, this was going on. The principal admitted that she was doing it. My understanding is that they requested that the practice stop immediately, which was great news for us. We were like, okay, they're going to stop it. However, they didn't redistribute the classes. And this was a COVID year. There were many moving parts. However, when you've been made known that they're segregating classes, then you need to go in and you need to create new class lists.
Yeah, right.
They did not do that. They did not do that at all. My other understanding was that she was supposed to turn in her class list to her superior to check over. Do I know if that happened? I have no idea.
Not to mention, I mean, just letting all the kids know what happened. That's wrong. That's not what we're going to do. But obviously, if she's still in charge, you're never going to get that kind of admission or that kind of accountability.
You are correct. I would agree.
Kyla Posey is the mom who filed a federal discrimination complaint against Maryland Elementary School in Atlanta after learning that her daughter was being segregated by her race in classes, as we were just discussing. Kyla, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the complaints that you have filed. Best of luck with your daughters as well. And, thank you for stepping up on this. I know it, obviously you described all the turmoil that your family has had to endure, but we need good people to stand up when bad things are happening, and you did.
I will continue.
Good for you.
Thank you, Kyla.
You definitely have our support. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Now, from the Signature Bank Studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This is some interesting data. The percentage of 12th graders who have a driver's license, have ever tried alcohol.
Have what?
Ever tried alcohol. Mm-hmm. Ever go on dates. Work for pay at all during the school year. And looking over 40 years from like 76 to 16. 1976, 2016. The percentage of 12th graders, so high school seniors, had a driver's license, tried alcohol, go on dates, work for pay. All of those things have declined significantly. Have a driver's license, tried alcohol, dated, they were all north of 85% of 12th graders in 1976. By the end of the continuum here, 2016, fewer than 75% had a driver's license. Fewer than 65% had tried alcohol. Fewer than 60% had dated ever. And just under 55%, so a little more than half, had worked at all for pay during the school year. I wonder what you attribute that to. What does that say about our culture?
Well, I can tell you, as a mother of boys, boys with the whole Me Too movement are so afraid to ask girls out on dates because if they look at them wrong, they're afraid they'll be accused of something.
Yeah, but it was declining well before that. I mean, it went from north of 90%, north of 85%, I should say, in the mid-90s to under 75% by the first few years of this century. Well, it's just interesting. I mean, it seems like this is not just boys. This is boys and girls. So all 12th graders. 2019 paper on the topic. It just seems like young people are less independent or certainly at an early age, you know, in their teenage years. I mean, you're talking about even as they enter into young adulthood, they're just less independent. Is that a problem? For more on that topic and others related to the development of young people, please be joined again by Dr. Leonard Sachs, the author of Boys Adrift, The Five Factors Driving the Growing Epidemic of Unmotivated Boys and Underachieving Young Men. We got a lot to talk about with Dr. Sachs. Dr. Sachs, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What about that? Looking at seniors, high school seniors, and seeing such a significant drop-off over four decades in those 12th graders that have a driver's license, have ever dated, have ever worked for pay. I mean, it's still a majority, but it's a smaller majority.
Well, specifically regarding boys asking girls out, I've visited over 400 schools over the last 22 years. I've met with a lot of boys across the United States, and I've asked them about this, and they're pretty blunt. They'd rather look at screens. They'd rather look at porn. I've talked to deans at high schools who says our biggest problem is the boys don't want to show up. You know, we've had a school dance at this school for 100 years, but the boys don't turn out anymore. The girls are dancing with other girls because there's no boys, and we're thinking we're just going to phase it out. And we ask the boys, why don't you want to ask a girl out to the dance? And they're like, girls online are way prettier. So, the porn and the screens and the video games are a major factor that's diverting boys' motivation away from the real world.
But how are we going to get boys off of their screens?
Okay, so I wrote another, you mentioned my book, Boys Adrift, which absolutely is all about this. But then I read another book called The Collapse of Parenting, which was a New York Times bestseller, because the parents have to take the lead here. You can't expect boys in this culture, and by this culture I mean the culture of Bruno Mars, Drake, Cardi B, and Megan Thee Stallion. You can't expect boys in this culture to say, oh, I'm going to be virtuous and I'm going to refrain from looking at porn, even though all my friends are. It's just not realistic. You have to limit, govern, and guide what your son is doing with his screens.
You wrote a piece recently about boys' schools, all boys' schools, that is, and whether or not that could be part of the answer to boys falling behind academically in terms of the grades they get in high school, the percentage of boys that go on to post-secondary education as compared to girls.
So what boys need to get excited about education is very different from what girls need to get excited about education. In this country, we deploy what I call the middle-class script. The middle-class script is work hard at high school, get into college, work hard at college, get a good job, have a good life. That doesn't work. It does not motivate boys. Because boys who are perfectly content with their video games and their pornography, it's not going to work. You need to create a completely different culture where it's cool for a boy to be a gentleman and a scholar. And I saw that firsthand at this school in Dallas, where I have now visited on 8 days on 4 different trips over the last 12 years, the Barack Obama Male Leadership Academy, where they really have taken this to heart and have created a school where boys are proud to earn an A, to win points for their team. You have boys from low-income households demanding more books to read in their spare time. And the school's done extremely well, way outpacing basically every other school in the district and in the top 10% across the state of Texas on the state tests, despite the fact that more than 80% of these kids come from low-income households, qualify for free student lunches. Now, I emphasize just putting boys in a building without girls accomplishes nothing good and often leads to catastrophe. Teachers have to be trained in how you lead a boys' classroom. It's very different from a co-ed classroom. I can tell you about lots of schools that have failed miserably because they thought all they had to do was build a school without girls and good things would happen. That's not what happens. But that school did their homework, and they've had very good outcomes now over the past 12 years.
Ironically entitled Barack Obama Academy. What's happening there? I read the piece of competition. They're separated into houses, and you compete.
House competition.
Yeah, you compete. But going back to what you said before about building men of character, turning young men into young gentlemen. I mean, so it's not just competition. It also has to be or character formation needs to be part of that competition, I guess, maybe. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. The school leaders have to have a very clear understanding of what they're trying to accomplish. It's not primarily about grades and test scores. It's about becoming a better man. And they have advisories where men talk to boys about, what does it mean to be a good man? Does a good man look at porn? Does a good man spend his free time playing video games? And it's really eye-opening because the boys are coming from a culture, the culture of popular American culture, where, yeah, all the boys look at porn and all the boys spend their free time playing video games. And so you've got to have men coming in and saying, no, actually, becoming a better man means you find something better to do with your time than look at porn.
So he also wrote another article about politics and parenting, that children of liberal parents are more likely to be depressed. Can you explain how that works?
So, yeah, that's a remarkable finding. So, you know, we've had scholars like Gene Twenge who've been studying kids over the past decades and seeing who's more likely to be depressed. And so a very robust finding in this research is that girls are more likely to be depressed than boys are. That's been true for as long as anyone's been studying this issue, going back many decades. But recently, they've discovered something new, which is that the children of left-of-center parents are more likely to be depressed than the children of right-of-center parents. And it's now such a big effect that boys who are the sons of left-of-center parents are more likely to be depressed than girls who are the daughters of right-of-center parents. In other words, the effect of the parents' politics is now greater than the effect of whether you happen to be a boy or a girl. And that's something new, and it's a big effect. And so in my article on this topic, I explored the various conjectures as to why this may be so. And I think the most persuasive argument is that left-of-center parents tend to be more permissive. Left-of-center parents tend to say, well, you know, I think good parenting means letting kids decide. And the problem with that is if you let kids decide, you end up with a lot of kids who are spending a lot of time on social media. And social media clearly is a major driver of depression for teenage kids. Right-of-center parents are more likely to say, no, actually, I'm going to limit what you do with your device, and I think I have that authority as a parent. Left-of-center parents are now less comfortable exercising their authority. Now, I've been a family doctor for over 30 years, and I can tell you that as recently as 20 years ago, that difference really wasn't there. Left-of-center parents were very comfortable being authoritative parents and laying down the law. But that's much less true today. That's changed. And left-of-center parents are now often into what they call gentle parenting, which means you never say no. The child is always right. Because if you say no, then you're being authoritarian and you must be a Republican. So that's something new that I've observed in my own practice and that researchers are documenting nationwide, that left-of-center parents are now uncomfortable doing their job as parents.
Have you studied left-of-center parents who let their kids do a gap year, which then turns into 2 years, which then turns into 3 years?
No, I don't know of good research that looks at that intersection between the there's actually only a handful of good studies looking at the politics of the parents and outcomes, and I'm not aware that any of them looked at the gap year. There is a growing proportion of young people, boys more than girls, who are adrift. And that, of course, is the focus of my book, Boys Adrift, although we're seeing a lot of girls adrift as well.
So, you know, such a small percentage of boys or girls go to all boys. Let's just focus on boys for a second. Go to all boys schools. And so for the parents that have their boy, their son in, you know, the standard issue neighborhood government school, what's the advice and counsel you give to make sure that they don't end up adrift?
Yeah. So you want to make sure your son is attending a boy-friendly school. And a co-ed school can be friendly to boys without disengaging girls. And so you're moving to a new neighborhood. You want to know, is this school that my son is slated to attend, is that going to be a good choice for him? Some very simple metrics. If it's a high school, go and see what proportion of the kids earning honors last year were boys. Look at the dean's list, the honor roll. It should be roughly 50-50, but increasingly in the United States, at a growing proportion of schools, we find that girls greatly outnumber the boys. So looking nationwide, we do have national data on who's the valedictorian at American high schools, and girls now outnumber boys by 3-1. And when you look at the boys who are the valedictorians, those boys tend to be immigrants from East Asia, South Asia. White, black, and Latino boys in this country increasingly regard doing well at school as something that girls do, because schools become unfriendly to boys. Another good question is snowballs. Is the throwing of snowballs permitted? I attended public schools in Ohio, K-12, And, you know, I grew up outside Cleveland. We got a lot of snow, lake effect snow. And during the winter months, we, you know, recess and lunch, we'd put on our coats and go outside and throw snowballs at each other. And the teachers would join us. I remember Mr. Albers was a great shot. He'd get you right between the eyes every time, students against teachers. Not anymore. Today, two kids start throwing snowballs at each other on school property, and teacher comes out and says, what are you guys doing? Not allowed to do that. You got to wait till after school and go somewhere else. No throwing of snowballs allowed on school property. And the unintended message the boys are getting is that I'm not welcome here. Boys doing things that boys have always done, throwing snowballs, pointing fingers at each other, saying, bang, bang, you're dead, drawing a picture of a weapon, now gets you in trouble. That's what I mean when I say that many schools have become unfriendly to boys, and it accomplishes nothing. Because that boy who gets in trouble because he drew a picture of a rifle, he's not going to turn into a boy who loves scrapbooking and talking about his feelings. he's going to say, school sucks. I'm going to go home and play Grand Theft Auto, where I get rewarded for killing people. So the lack of awareness of these differences pushes boys away from school. So you got to ask around and see what's the story with this particular school. There's plenty of schools out there that are friendly to boys. You might have to move. My wife and I moved from Montgomery County, Maryland to Chester County, Pennsylvania, because we were unhappy with the choice of schools available in Montgomery County, Maryland, the People's Republic of Maryland.
Yeah, right. Right, and we know the feeling. Yeah, wow, that's I love the snowball test. That's really good.
Yeah.
Dr. Leonard Sachs, he is the author of bestsellers Boys Adrift, as and many others. And Dr. Sachs, we thank you for joining us again. Appreciate your insights.
Thanks for inviting me. Bye-bye.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.